Sherry Mason is a scientist with a robust curiosity, bright aquamarine eyes, and a passion for water. She's chair of the Department of Geology and Environmental Sciences at the State University of New York in Fredonia, outside Buffalo. One morning in 2011, Professor Mason stepped aboard a wooden sailing ship for a voyage across North America's Great Lakes.
It's a War of 1812 tall ship.
Mason's specialty at the time was atmospheric chemistry. She was going to teach a class to a group of undergraduates on how the lakes were polluted by chemical-laden rainfall.
It's just an incredible experience, and I couldn't sleep.
How incredible? She stayed up for 36 hours.
I was so excited, and probably because of the delirium of being awake for so long, you know, you get weird things coming into your head, and I was watching the water go past the boat, and I was like, as much as we know about plastic pollution in the world's oceans, have I ever heard of any story about plastic pollution in the Great Lakes?
When Professor Mason returned to port, she consulted the existing scientific literature and found, well, she found nothing.
And as a scientist, that's actually pretty exciting. I mean, it's a disturbing kind of excitement.
So she jumped in, not literally. The next year, Mason and a team of students skimmed the waters of Lake Superior, Lake Huron, and Lake Erie for plastic pollution.
And the results that we got from that first investigation back in 2012 were so startling that it basically just took over my life, and I decided I was no longer an atmospheric chemist. I was a freshwater plastic pollution researcher.
Dr. Mason shocked the world with her discovery of microbead pollution.
75% of what we capture is actually smaller than a millimeter in size, which is basically the size of a grain of sugar, or the period at the end of a sentence. I mean, that's the size of the plastic that we're finding.
The tiny dots and fibers of plastic pollution that Mason found in the Great Lakes all started life as something else, as cleanser, toothpaste, car tires, fleece jackets, grocery bags, and milk bottles. Microscopic and persistent, they were infecting the environment.
These pieces of plastic are so incredibly small that they can be ingested by zooplankton, which is the very base of the food chain. And if they're ingested by zooplankton, then zooplankton get eaten by fish, and small fish get eaten by bigger fish, and bigger fish get eaten, you know, eat medium fish, and you work up the food chain to us.
But as we followed Professor Mason's work and that of her colleagues, we noticed something. While scientists were finding microplastic in places like remote Mongolian lakes and the Italian Alps, and in food products like beer and sea salt, no one appeared to have examined a basic element of daily life, our drinking water. Just as Professor Mason had her eureka moment while sailing sleepless on the Great Lakes, we now had ours. So we tested drinking water in dozens of cities, including Los Angeles, Jakarta, Indonesia, and Kampala, Uganda. We found tiny traces of a really big problem. In the first study of its kind, Orb Media has learned that microscopic plastic fibers have contaminated drinking water from cities all around the world. These tiny fibers are pouring out of faucets from New York to New Delhi and into cups, coffee pots, and baby bottles.
People were always like, is this in our drinking water? Is this in our drinking water? And I was always like, I don't know. And I didn't really think that it was.
Professor Mason agreed to oversee Orb's study with researcher Mary Kasuth at the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health. The results are disturbing. 83% of the samples we tested were contaminated with microscopic plastic fibers as small as 1/10 of a millimeter. This previously unknown contamination defies wealth and geography. The number of plastic fibers found in tap water samples from New York City was no different from that found in samples from Beirut, Lebanon, and Quito, Ecuador.
There are certain commons that connect us all to each other: air, water, soil. And what we have universally found time and time again is if you contaminate any of those commons, it gets in everything.
In 2013, microplastics researcher Mark Brown attended a meeting in Pasadena, California. Scientists and representatives of major apparel companies were meeting to discuss ways to create synthetic textiles that were less likely to shed fibers in the wash. During a break outside the venue, Brown was approached by representatives of leading global brands.
Marketing and sort of legal people from their companies and went, is this the new asbestos? And I said, well, you've actually got a fibre item. It's more abundant than asbestos, and it's making up all of your products. And you've got additional chemicals added onto it.
When you have big pieces of plastic, it's an eyesore, and people get it. They're like, oh, this is bad. But when you tell them that this thing is out there and they can't really see it, it makes it extremely difficult for them to understand the importance.
From the soles of your shoes to the contact lenses in your eyes, from the phone in your pocket to the food in your refrigerator, the evidence is unmistakable. We're living in the plastic age. Worldwide plastic production has rocketed from 1.5 million tons in the 1950s to over 322 million tons last year. If plastic was a country, it would be the world's 20th largest economy, bigger than those of Austria, Argentina, Egypt, and dozens of others. The world wants plastic, and it's piling up. In the Filipino town of Dagupan, the pile is on fire. Located on the South China Sea, Dagupan is famous for its local variety of a beloved Philippine staple, the milkfish. But if the coveted milkfish is Dagupan's pride, the city's shame is a 50-year-old landfill sitting atop the town's gorgeous Pacific beachfront. This 42,000-ton mountain feeds plastic into the ocean on coastal winds and during the island's many storms. Today, it's on fire. The town's mayor, Belen Fernandez, has her sleeves rolled up and is holding a fire hose trained on the toxic blaze. She staked her career on removing the dump. To do that, Fernandez has teamed with an American company to build a waste-to-energy plant that will turn 5 decades of discarded plastic into diesel fuel for the local fishing fleet.
The number one problem really here are the plastics. The plastics of 50 years and up to today.
The Philippines is the world's third biggest source of plastic marine pollution, behind China and Indonesia. Plastic waste in the seas winds up in seafood, a terrifying prospect in fishing villages like this one.
The mayor was astounded, so she actually has the people that do the gutting of the fish now looking for plastic.
Jill Boughton is president of Waste to Worth Innovations, which is building the new energy plant.
It scares her to death because that's the livelihood of the city. So if they start finding plastic in fish, she's got one more reason to hate this. Okay? One more reason, not that she already doesn't hate this, but one more reason, because the fishing is the livelihood of the Gupon. It is predicated on fishing.
The most important thing always is we will have a clean river, a clean sea, a clean beach, and a healthy life for everyone when there is no plastic anymore.
Global recycling rates are abysmal. The U.S. recycles only 12% of its plastic waste, according to 2012 numbers. In Europe, it was 36%. Rates were far lower in Asia, Africa, and South America.
Plastics are inherently recyclable. What's preventing us from recycling more, I'd argue, is inadequate, inappropriate, or if you like, a lack of proper consideration at the design stage for what's going to happen at the end of life.
Richard Thompson knows something about microplastics. In fact, he's credited with coining the term. In his office at Plymouth University on the English coast, Thompson is busy trying to find ways to keep plastics out of the environment.
If we think about plastics, the benefit they bring is completely decoupled from all of the harm. It's possible to have my fizzy drink bottle, my crisp packet, the lightweight part in my car, without those pieces needing to escape into the environment.
Every big piece of plastic in the environment will eventually fragment into smaller bits. Scientists estimate trillions of pieces of plastic are locked in the melting Arctic ice cap, and that a trillion more float on the ocean surface. Many scientists even consider plastic pollution to be hazardous waste. Yet remarkably, here it is, suspended in tap water samples from cities and towns around the world. If plastic fibers are in drinking water, they're also in foods prepared with that water. Soup, rice, pasta, bread, and baby formula. And we are consuming them.
And it surprised us how readily plastics can be ingested. We're then starting to work out, well, do these have any adverse effects? Is there anything that's particularly bad to the animal about having plastic in its gut? Or is it more that the plastic can bring contaminants from the surrounding water and release them into the tissues?
That's Tamara Galloway, professor of ecotoxicology at the University of Exeter in England. Galloway and her team study how animals respond to microplastics and to even smaller plastic pollutants called nanoplastics that are measured in the thousandth of a thousandth of an inch. In a chilly labyrinth of laboratories in an Exeter University basement, researcher Matthew Cole is recreating the plastic food chain by introducing nanoplastic particles to algae, which are fed on by tiny zooplankton that will themselves later be eaten by small freshwater fish called sticklebacks. Cole is documenting how plastics absorb pollutants and ultimately how they might affect wildlife and humans.
Particularly in coastal zones, you tend to get these quite short-lived, persistent organic pollutants called POPs for short. And these chemicals can quite readily bind to the surface of plastic. And in particular, microplastics, because they're so small, they have a relatively large surface area. And so that large surface area gives lots of binding room for these different kinds of chemical pollutants. And so if that plastic then gets ingested by an animal, there's concern that those chemical pollutants bound to the surface of the plastic could have an acute toxic effect to that animal.
Richard Thompson.
It became clear very early on that, yeah, the plastics would release those chemicals, and actually the conditions in the gut would facilitate really quite rapid release.
Microscopic particles and fibers are a source of concern for a few reasons. They've been shown to interact with the algae and plankton that form the basis of the marine food chain. They clog the gills and digestive tracts of fish and are prevalent in filter feeders like oysters and mussels. And they've been shown to act as a sort of shuttle for toxic chemicals in the ocean and in freshwater. Chemicals crowd on board the plastic at sea and step off again once they're inside the animal that's eaten them. On top of that, there are the very chemicals used to make the plastic that allow it to take form as everything from bath toys to the lining of soup cans to truck bumpers. Some of these chemicals are known carcinogens, while others are endocrine disruptors, chemicals that monkey with human hormonal systems, especially those of children.
What we don't know is what implication that might have for human health.
It's not just that you're exposed to plastic. I mean, from the moment a child is born nowadays, it's already been exposed to 300 synthetic chemicals. Any human health effects that you're going to experience as you get older to tease out what the ultimate source of those was. There's no way to tease it out. And this is what, you know, quite frankly, industry uses against us. They're like, against us. This is what industry uses against the argument of being concerned about these chemicals.
Isn't that really crazy that we've been using these plastics since the Second World War, and new ones keep on being developed, and a whole host of other chemicals, but we haven't got basic understanding about whether or not they cause problems.
On the opposite side of the world, Dr. Mark Brown is heaving himself over a stone wall and down into a hidden storm drain. He's looking for microfibers washing into the surf at Coogee Beach in Sydney, Australia.
If you're going to release a product into the environment, we really need to know what it does to humans.
Plastic and all that makes it and is absorbed by it has infiltrated our drinking water in the form of invisible fibers and particles. The burden this contamination might place on human health is unknown, but scientists say there's reason to be concerned.
We know that they're ubiquitous in the environment. We know that you're ubiquitous within living organisms. And we know the impacts that plastics are having on some of these organisms. And I think that that's enough of a reason to be concerned and to kind of raise the flag and think, you know, let's start thinking about how we can deal with this as opposed to waiting for all the data and then it's too late.
Even if we got a magic wand this afternoon, we could stop all imports of plastic to the ocean, big and small, we're still going to see more microplastics because of the fragmentation of the large items that are already in the system, the legacy items.
Microplastics will be with us for a while. But if we can't remove what's already in the environment, we can work to choke off the flow of new plastic into water, soil, and the air. We can all cut down on our use of disposable plastic items. Skip the straw. drive less, bring reusable bags to the grocery, wash your fleece and synthetic garments less often and on a gentle cycle, store your food in glass. Our study of plastic in drinking water is likely to be the first of many. It's the visceral example of just how far plastic has penetrated human life and human anatomy.
It's everywhere. It's in our air. It's in our water. It's in our food. It's in our salt. It's in our beer. It's in our bodies.